somehow I will know.
Join KABU February 7th from noon to 4 as we pay tribute to John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
To celebrate Valentine's Day and Oregon's birthday, KABU Community Radio will host a special day of news and public affairs programming. For Love of a Better World will be a 12-hour special focusing on the transformational place we find ourselves, solutions to get out of the muck, and the groups and individuals who are fighting the good fight. For Love of a Better World, KABU's News and Public Affairs 12-hour special, February 14th, from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
So having a tough time right now. They're getting their lunch fancy with them every day.
The time is 6:04, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Up next is Labor Radio, a special hour-long Labor Radio, and Prison Pipeline will be with us next week at the normal time at 6:30. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide can be found online at redirectguide.com.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. I'd like to welcome you to the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio, here on KABU, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. My name is Tina Turner Morfitt. I'm a member of the American Federation State, County, Municipal Employees, and the current president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host.
Good evening, our Labor Radio listeners. This is Deborah Hall from the American Federation of Teachers and also currently the president, the treasurer for the Coalition of Black Trade Unions here in the area.
Well, tonight, as you were told, we have an hour-long segment. And tonight we're going to highlight a historical event that took place on December 19th that includes the City of Portland, the Portland Police Association, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. This is an historical event, results a lawsuit that was filed by the Department of Justice against the Portland Police Bureau regarding the use of excessive force, specifically when dealing with people who have mental illness. And it has culminated into a fairness hearing, which will be held on February 18th at 9 a.m. But before we get into our segment, I'd like to remind our listeners a few things about the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. We are an international organization. We have 42 chapters throughout the United States and Canada. We're divided into 10 regions. Oregon is located in Region 10. That includes Washington State, Nevada, Northern and Southern California. We have our annual membership begins at about $43 a year. We are affiliated with Oregon chapter and the National AFL-CIO. We meet monthly on the second Tuesday of every month. Now that's a change. We used to meet the first. Now we're meeting on the second Tuesday of every month at the William Lucy Labor Center located at 6025 East Burnside. Our meeting starts at 6 o'clock. We can be contacted at orcbtu10@gmail.com. The mission of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists is to be a conduit representing our respective international unions to bridge a gap between the black community and organized labor, and to speak on matters of concern to the black community. As I stated earlier, Tonight's segment is extremely special, and we're going to talk about a historical event. And our guest tonight is Kelvin Hall, and he's going to walk us through what led to this lawsuit, who filed it, the current agreement, and the work yet to be done regarding a fairness hearing, which again is scheduled on February 18th at 9 a.m. Kelvin Hall is a volunteer public advocate who has worked on projects with the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. This group filed a complaint with the United States Department of Justice against the Portland Police. Kelvin, can you give us some context to this federal lawsuit?
Well, before I start, I would like to thank you, Tina and Deborah, for having me on your show. I'm one of the hundreds of thousands of listeners who are regular listeners to your show. So thank you very much. Thank you for allowing me to be here today to speak as a volunteer public advocate on behalf of this historic settlement agreement. History informs us that labor unions have always been on the forefront of fighting for social justice. It's really a real honor to be on this show. The work done by the Albina Ministerial Alliance and Coalition for Justice and Police Reform Committee is in fact historic. I joined Dr. Audrey Terrell, Portland Chapter President of the NAACP Chapter 1120, to get the good news out about this settlement agreement. We are not officers, nor are we paid, but stand in support of this agreement. What I would like to do is give a historical context, if that's okay. This agreement is historic in time and place. Says to me, there's been only one perfect policy created in this world. It was carved out of stone on a mountaintop, and when it was done, it was called the Ten Commandments. Everything else written to govern human actions has needed to be reviewed, changed, and or debated in order to create a shared community. The context that I would like to share today is in context to the summer of 1787. Delegates to the Constitutional Convention gathered in Philadelphia to create the document that would establish the government of the United States. On September 17th, that landmark document, our Constitution, was signed. This document shaped our history and guides our future. The founders did not create a federal police force. They had a deep concern about standing armies during time of peace. One of the founding fathers, James Madison, made the following statement during the convention of 1787. A standing military force with an overgrown executive branch will not long be safe companions to liberty. This is the reason American law enforcement systems today is composed of around 18,000 separate state and local entities. When law enforcement responsibilities are divided among 18,000 agencies headed by elected local officials, it becomes extremely difficult for anyone to set himself up as a tyrant.
Tina and Deborah. However, when our elected officials fail to exercise courage, make decisions that balance community interests and government interests, their lack of actions adversely impact the system put in place by our founders. When this happens, only the courts can establish the rule for living together. United States Justice Brennan stated, such efforts of federal courts are to determine boundaries with the goal to protect the rights from tyranny. The middle has to be filled up by the democratic process. That's the job of citizens and public advocates and public agencies. James Madison also stated that all societies are made up of warring factions, rich against the poor, religion against religion, race against race. A small republic too often falls prey to one of these factions. The result, lawlessness and oppression, especially against the minority. It is only in a large republic with different-minded people that one faction can't gain control. In such a republic, the liberties of all people are safeguarded. Such republic was dedicated If such a republic was dedicated to justice, protected by truth, and the spirit of the people, would he believe, as James Madison stated, it lasts for ages, but first it must exist? I would like to give you a context. First, what do we have, or why do we have a justice system? We have a justice system to do the following: to deter crime, for rehabilitation, punishment, to convict the guilty and acquit the innocent, and for social order, which is where we're at currently. How do we want our justice system to work? Efficiently, effectively, and with limits on government. And so when we take a look at this current effort and this settlement agreement, I wanted to give a historical framework, because the founders knew that we needed to be able to have elected officials oversee structures in a way of to ensure accountability. And when our elected officials fail to do that, then we then have the participation of those folks who participate in civil disobedience, which are public advocates. And I wanted to give that historical context as we move forward in answering some specific questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Kelvin. This is Deborah Hall. I'm again with a question. And who, again, can you tell us, filed the suit? The Department of Justice?
The Albina Ministry Alliance and the Coalition for Justice and Police Reform Committee. And let me just cite that this committee is truly reflective of a shared community. It's black, it's white, it's gays, it's straight, it's Protestants, it's Christians, it's non-Christians. So it truly reflects a shared community.
And why did they file the suit with the Department of Justice?
The suit was filed with the Department of Justice because there were a series of events where citizens with mental health issues suffered and lost their life at the hands of the Portland police. And so therefore, with the continued inquiry to the city council, the Albina Ministry Alliance felt that it was necessary to make a file and an appeal to the highest court in the land to seek some type of inquiry and investigation.
Well, it seems to me that with this lawsuit, they have access that other groups or other organizations don't have. Why is that?
Well, what I would say is that other groups, in fact, do have access. It's just that in context to the Albina Ministry Alliance, they have over a 20-year history for standing up for social justice causes for all people and on all issues. And this long-standing credibility gave them the standing to be able to present a grievance and follow it through to for this historic moment.
What are some of the good changes that have been proposed by the judge in this agreement?
Changes are being made to the Bureau's use of force policies, including that police must de-escalate their use of violence as the resistance from the subject decreases. That's one. Two, officers who are found in civil court to have violated someone's rights must be subject to an internal affairs investigation, that's an IR, presuming they are found guilty of misconduct unless the evidence show they are not. Third, supervisors will be trained to conduct annual performance reviews on officers. And the final good change proposed within the agreement, officers will be banned from using offensive epithet language, including mentals or prohibition that extends to internal communications.
I also get the feeling that the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform believes the proposed settlement changes don't go far enough. Can you please lay out for us those concerns, Kelvin?
You bet, I sure can. The city was not required to change provisions of existing collective bargaining contracts, which are inhibiting effective investigations, such as the so-called 48-hour rule, allowing 48 hours after deadly force incidents before officers are interviewed, and provisions limiting independent independent civilian investigations of misconduct, including shootings. The new position that will come from this historic lawsuit, the compliance officer community liaison position, is created to oversee implementation of the agreement, but it has no power before the federal court when recommending changes. While some new restrictions are made about taser use, the agreement retains and expands loopholes for excessive taser use. The agreement is not explicit enough in calling officers to use the least force necessary, doesn't allow for a matrix tying maximum force levels to certain levels of resistance, doesn't prohibit the use of weapons, animals, or vehicles as intimidation when no threat exists, and doesn't prohibit the use of force on down injured subjects. The agreement prohibits officers with sustained complaints about use of force mistreatment of people with mental illness from serving on the crisis intervention team or training the division, even though a very few such complaints are ever sustained. Therefore, more stringent prohibitions are needed, such as if the officer has been documented with a pattern of inappropriate behavior in a 90-day calendar period. In addition to that, the agreement mentions the Training Advisory Council, which advises the police on training policies, but should also require community members' involvement in all aspects of training, including developing and facilitating and participating in trainings. In addition to that, the agreement calls for enhancement to data collection, but does not require tracking of all community contacts, including mere conversations. Officers subject to scrutiny under the employee information system call for manager review if there are three uses of force in 1 month. But that trigger should be three uses of force in a 90-day calendar period.
Wow. But it seems like there are other concerns about accountability.
You're absolutely right. One sentence in the agreement prohibits appeals to the Citizen Review Committee, CRC as it is called, by people who survive police shootings or the survivors of a death in custody victim. The city should implement a Fred Bryant clause in the city code allowing such an appeal to happen. Bryant, the late father of Keaton Otis, was denied such an appeal. In addition, the Internal Police Review Board, which considers the use of force cases and potential discipline for officers, remain closed to the public and the person involved in the incident being reviewed for possible misconduct. The Department of Justice letter of findings found this curious. So the agreement should provide for some community access to these hearings. The agreement creates the optimistic but unrealistic timeline of 180 days to finish misconduct investigations, including appeals to CRC, which could allow officers to go free if it is not met. An escape valve must be added so that if the timeline is not met, the investigation does not come to a halt. Similarly, it's important to take note that the agreement calls for the CRC to complete its appeal hearings in 21 days, whereas they currently take 60 to 90 days. The agreement enshrines the differential standard of review that makes the CRC decide whether the police supervisor made a reasonable decision, rather than whether the officer violated the policy. The community expects a review body to examine the case and determine the appropriate findings based on their own analysis.
Well, if you've just joined us, this is the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio, and we have a guest with us tonight. His name is Kevin Hall. Kelvin is a volunteer public advocate, and tonight we're discussing the outcome of a lawsuit that was filed against the Portland Police Bureau regarding use of force.
Can I clarify one thing quickly? If you all heard Kelvin mention the CRC, that is the Citizen Review Committee, not the Columbia River Crossing, and I thought I'd clarify that because this is a labor show. We have folks listening.
Great clarification.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. And so what issues have not been addressed in this agreement?
Well, you know, there are a number of things, but in context to where the agreement is silent, the agreement does not direct the city how to expend resources toward lowering the amount of force needed and improving accountability. As a result, the city has budgeted roughly $5 million per year over 5 years, totaling over $25 million, but never engaged in a public dialogue about where the money would be best spent. The agreement calls upon the Independent Police Review Division to conduct a meaningful independent investigation into misconduct, but does not outline which kinds of cases IPR should handle. Examples should include shootings, deaths in custody, serious injury, and incidents of high concern to the community. The agreement does not call for mandatory drug testing of officers after deadly force incidents or incidents in which force leads to hospitalization.
Well, Kelvin, I understand that you're not doing this work alone. Who else is helping you with this?
Well, you know, what's wonderful about this effort is that it's not a black issue. It's not a white issue. It's not a gay issue. It is a citizen issue. And the coalition of Albina Ministry Alliance and Coalition for Justice and Police Reform represents that shared community. And so, therefore, it is a diverse group of folks who just simply are saying, we want democracy and our Constitution to be reflected in the way our bureaus are interacting with our citizens. And so this heroic group of folks are diverse and are fighting for all the city's 95 neighborhoods, and they are certainly representative in terms of ethnic groups, gender, and all other kind of category.
So can you describe for us some of the meetings that you've already participated in? Because it's my understanding that you are working with the community and have gone out and had these educational teachings.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that the judge identified that he wanted to see happen was that the community was to be informed about this historic moment. And so Dr. Terrell, and I want to say that she is on fire. Some folks say that Hurricane Sandy brought wind and that Katrina brought destruction. But there's another storm in this city, and her name is Dr. Terrell. She's the new president of the NAACP, and she wanted to create a process for citizens to know what's going on, and so she created a strategic strategy by which to go out to various neighborhoods within the city and share information about this historic moment and take questions. And what is significant about her leadership in this context is that this is truly a vehicle where the folks can participate and ask questions, agree, disagree, and really get their frustrations out in a way that maybe they haven't been able to do before. One of the things that Dr. Terrell says, she quotes Dr. King, psychological freedom confirms physical freedom. So when folks can express their frustrations and their discontent and their dissent, then they are psychologically free. We have been communicating with the city's neighborhoods, talking about this agreement and encouraging folks to be prepared to testify on February the 18th to either hopefully have items included within this settlement and or to present a position or perspective that may have been missed.
So it's my understanding that you have, there are four more community meetings that are scheduled, two of which you and Dr. Terrell are working on. So did you want to let the public know what those dates are?
Well, you know, first of all, again, Tina, I want to thank you very much. The first date will be Friday. I'll just list all the dates here. Friday, February 7th, 24th at St. John's, All Nations Church, Pastor Cliff Chappelle. Saturday, February 8th, 2014, 2 to 4, St. John's Community Center, New Hope Baptist Church, Walter Hills, approximately from 2 to 4, and Thursday, February the 13th from 68 Rosewood Community Center. The fairness hearing will take place on February the 18th at the federal courthouse.
So can you tell me what is expected to happen at this fairness hearing?
Well, the fairness hearing is the opportunity for, well, let me just step back a little bit. The city of Portland is made up of 95 neighborhoods, and what might be an issue in Northeast Portland may not be an issue in Reed College issue. So the judge, without taking bias to any neighborhood, has opened up the entire city to come in and then give their viewpoint in terms of policy or suggestions or recommendations that need to be included within this historical settlement. And what is exciting about this is that's how democracy works. If you remember when James Madison fought to create a more perfect union, he did it, yes, to bring the states together, but he also did it to free the tyranny from the United States from the control of the terrorists by the British. And so what essentially this allows is for folks to be able to give their opinions on how they think the city should move forward from this point. If we look at it from another historical perspective, it took a group of women suffragettes to fight to give women the vote. It took a federal vote to end slavery. So this is just consistent with the progression of democracy in our United States.
The people united will not be defeated. And the reason that I say that, folks, this is Deborah Hall, is that it's imperative for all of us to, you know, speak up. And we would encourage folks from various neighborhoods in Portland to show up and to, you know, come and, you know, find out some of the things that are being talked about, because the police force affects each and every one of us every day in ways that we don't even imagine. And so this is a time when our city, when our government is asking us, what would we like to see, what are some things that are important to us. And so I hope that you all will be able to make it on February 19th for the date of the hearing. And I sure know that I'm going to be there. I become involved with Portland Jobs with Justice, which is not only a labor organization, but works with various organizations across the city of Portland. And Jobs with Justice has also become involved in this endeavor to take it up for the citizens of our area. And we hope that you all will, you know, certainly be there, or with your questions, you can certainly sign up to testify on that day.
So, Kelvin, when you initially started and you talked about the lawsuit in general, you made the comment that there was a concern about the use of force against mental illness. Why is it that it was looked at from that perspective?
Well, the United States Supreme Court has given a broad range for pretext stop and police matters, and so therefore, if in context to the federal standing, in order to initiate a process that would truly reflect a shared community, this approach was chosen to target the mental health in that context. And if I can just kind of add a footnote to that, the Oregon Municipal Law gives our city council the authority to develop policy and regulatory processes. And when they abate their responsibility, whether it's because of fear or the lack of courage, then they create a us against them kind of structure. When we have a leadership in this city, say, for example, Tina and Deborah, I see if there was a conflict that involved the police department and involved the community, you both are leaders. I could see you standing up, calling a press conference and saying, on the left side, I have my officers. Don't blame my officers who keep our city free from tyranny. On the right side, I have my activists and public advocates. Don't blame my public advocates and the faith community for making sure that we hold up our democracy and ensure constitutional rights. You blame me as an elected official. And until we can have a perfect system, I'll be the final decision and make sure things are impartial, impassionate, and that the finding of facts determine how things are to be done. I have yet to see a politician take that kind of courage and take that stand. So what happens in my lens is that then folks get into their kind of, if you will, enclave. Okay, you know, if I've got a degree in criminal justice, I think officers are heroes. They keep our city safe, you know, and I can understand them saying, hey, we're going to want to make sure that we protect our officers. And then at the same time, as an African-American man, history and current conditions suggest that we don't live in a colorblind society. So it is critical that you have elected leadership. But when that leadership is abated, and personal responsibility to govern is not initiated, then you have leadership coming from public advocates standing up and said, we're not pointing fingers, we just want justice. And if that means we have to stand alone to contact the United States Justice Department, then we're going to do that. And I think that's what we see here in context to this incident. We see community folks saying, it's not about a white man. It's not about a black man. It's not about gay. It's not about anybody, the rich or poor. It is about the fact that we have to stand up collectively together for rights so that all of us can benefit from a democracy that has safeguards. And I think, again, I'm real tough on elected officials because I see and have been a public advocate for over 10 years. I see white folks and black folks and gays and straights working together to fight for fairness and justice. They're not making over $90,000 and have a great health care benefits and posturing and not taking candidate positions and stepping up and taking the lead on controversial issues. They're marching in the streets. They're calling in the United States Justice Department. So my position in context to this is that this historic moment sends a clear message to those folks who are elected officials. Either you step up when things are controversial and you lead, or you need to be voted out of office. And that's not an AMA position. That's a Kelvin Hall position.
Amen, Brother Kelvin. Deborah Hall, with one more question. We had talked about this historic event that took place on December 19th of 2013. Was there any other seminal events that brought us to this point, to the December 19th and to the filing?
Yes. And I'm going to cite two examples. First, the longstanding work of a bunch of volunteers with the Albina Ministry Alliance, Dr. Leroy Haynes and Dr. T. Allen Bethel, along with previous leaders who have led the Albina Ministry Alliance, have put for decades in work to stand up to